other than cybernetics. For why on earth would an AI have a sexual or gender identity? Sex is a characteristic of organic multicellular beings. What can it possibly mean for a non-organic cybernetic being? Living in a box. One theme that science fiction has explored with far greater insight concerns the danger of technology being used to manipulate and control human beings. The Matrix depicts a world in which almost all humans are imprisoned in cyberspace, and everything they experience is shaped by a master algorithm. The Truman Show focuses on a single individual who is the unwitting star of a reality TV show. Unbeknownst to him, all his friends and acquaintances, including his mother, his wife, and his best friend, are actors. Everything that happens to him follows a well-crafted script, and everything he says and does is recorded by hidden cameras and avidly followed by millions of fans. However, both movies, despite their brilliance, in the end recoil from the full implications of their scenarios. They assume that the humans trapped within the Matrix have an authentic self that remains untouched by all the technological manipulations, and that beyond the Matrix awaits an authentic reality that the heroes can access if they only try hard enough. The Matrix is just an artificial barrier separating your inner, authentic self from the outer, authentic world. After many trials and tribulations, both heroes, Neo in the Matrix and Truman in the Truman Show, manage to transcend and escape the web of manipulations, discover their authentic selves, and reach the authentic promised land. Curiously enough, this authentic promised land is identical in all important respects to the fabricated Matrix. When Truman breaks out of the TV studio, he seeks to reunite with his high school sweetheart, whom the director of the TV show had eliminated from the show. Yet, if Truman fulfills that romantic fantasy, his life would look exactly like the perfect Hollywood dream that the Truman Show sold to millions of viewers across the globe, plus vacations in Fiji. The movie does not give us even a hint about what kind of alternative life Truman can find in the real world. Similarly, when Neo breaks out of the Matrix by swallowing the famous red pill, he discovers that the world outside is no different from the world inside. Both outside and inside, there are violent conflicts and people driven by fear, lust, love, and envy. The movie should have ended with Neo being told that the reality he has accessed is just a bigger matrix, and that if he wants to escape into the true real world, he must again choose between the blue pill and the red pill. The current technological and scientific revolution implies not that authentic individuals and authentic realities can be manipulated by algorithms and TV cameras, but rather that authenticity is a myth. People are afraid of being trapped inside a box, but they don't realize that they are already trapped inside a box, their brain, which is locked within the bigger box of human society with its myriad fictions. When you escape the Matrix, the only thing you discover is a bigger Matrix. When the peasants and workers revolted against the Tsar in 1917, they ended up with Stalin. When you begin to explore the manifold ways the world manipulates you, in the end, you realize that your core identity is a complex illusion created by neural networks. People fear that if they are trapped inside a box, they will miss out on all the wonders of the world. As long as Neo is stuck inside the Matrix and Truman is stuck inside the TV studio, they will never visit Fiji, Paris, or Machu Picchu. But in truth, everything you will ever experience in life is within your own body and your own mind. Breaking out of the Matrix or traveling to Fiji won't make any difference. It's not that somewhere in your mind there is an iron chest with a big red warning sign that reads, "Open only in Fiji," and when you finally travel to the South Pacific, you get to open the chest, and out come all kinds of special emotions and feelings that you can have only in Fiji. And if you never visit Fiji in your life, then you missed these special feelings forever. No. Whatever you can feel in Fiji, you can feel anywhere in the world, even inside the Matrix. Perhaps we are all living inside a giant computer simulation, Matrix-style. That would contradict all our national, religious, and ideological stories. but our mental experiences would still be real. If it turns out that human history is an elaborate simulation run on a supercomputer by rat scientists from the planet Zircon, that would be rather embarrassing for Karl Marx and the Islamic State. But these rat scientists would still have to answer for the Armenian genocide and for Auschwitz. How did they get that one past Zircon University's ethics committee? Even if the gas chambers were just electric signals in silicon chips, the experiences of pain, fear, and despair were not one iota less excruciating for that. Pain is pain, fear is fear, and love is love, even in the Matrix. It doesn't matter if the fear you feel is inspired by a collection of atoms in the outside world or by electrical signals manipulated by a computer. The fear is still real. So if you want to explore the reality of your mind, you can do that inside the Matrix as well as outside it. Most science fiction movies actually tell a very old story, the victory of mind over matter. 30,000 years ago, the story went like this. Mind imagines a stone knife. Hand creates a knife. Human kills mammoth. But the truth is that humans gained control of the world not so much by inventing knives and killing mammoths as by manipulating human minds. The mind is not the subject that freely shapes historical actions and biological realities. The mind is an object that is being shaped by history and biology. Even our most cherished ideals, freedom, love, creativity, are like a stone knife that somebody else shaped in order to kill some mammoth. According to the best scientific theories and the most up-to-date technological tools, the mind is never free of manipulation. There is no authentic self waiting to be liberated from the manipulative shell. Do you have any idea how many movies, novels, and poems you have consumed over the years, and how these artifacts have shaped and sharpened your idea of love? Romantic comedies are to love as porn is to sex and Rambo is to war. And if you think you can press some delete button and wipe out all trace of Hollywood from your subconscious and your limbic system, you are deluding yourself. We like the idea of shaping stone knives, but we don't like the idea of being stone knives ourselves. So the Matrix variation of the old mammoth story goes something like this. Mind imagines a robot. Hand creates a robot. Robot kills terrorists, but also tries to control the mind. Mind kills robot. Yet this story is false. The problem is not that the mind will not be able to kill the robot. The problem is that the mind that imagined the robot in the first place was already the product of much earlier manipulations. Therefore, killing the robot will not free us. Disney loses faith in free will. In 2015, Pixar Studios and Walt Disney Pictures released a far more realistic and troubling animation saga about the human condition, which quickly became a blockbuster among children and adults alike. Inside Out tells the story of an 11-year-old girl, Riley Anderson, who moves with her parents from Minnesota to San Francisco. Missing her friends and hometown, she has difficulties adjusting to her new life, and she tries to run away back to Minnesota. Yet, unbeknownst to Riley, there is a far greater drama going on. Riley is not the unwitting star of a TV reality show, and she isn't trapped in the Matrix. Rather, Riley herself is the Matrix, and there is something trapped inside her. Disney has built its empire by retelling one myth over and over. In countless Disney movies, the heroes face difficulties and dangers, but they eventually triumph by finding their authentic self and following their free choices. Inside Out brutally dismantles this myth. It adopts the latest neurobiological view of humans and takes viewers on a journey into Riley's brain, only to discover that she has no authentic self, and that she never makes any free choices. Riley is in fact a huge robot, managed by a collection of conflicting biochemical mechanisms, which the movie personifies as cute cartoon characters. The yellow and cheerful joy, the blue and morose sadness, the red and short-tempered anger, and so on. By manipulating a set of buttons and levers in headquarters, while watching Riley's every move on a huge TV screen, these characters control all of Riley's moods, decisions, and actions. Riley's failure to adjust to her new life in San Francisco results from a fuck-up in headquarters that has knocked her brain out of balance. To make things right, joy and sadness go on an epic journey through Riley's brain, riding on the train of thought, exploring the subconscious prison, and visiting the inner studio where a team of artistic neurons are busy producing dreams. As we follow these personified biochemical mechanisms into the depths of Riley's brain, we never encounter a soul, an authentic self, or a free will. Indeed, the moment of revelation on which the entire plot hinges happens not when Riley discovers her single authentic self, but rather when it becomes evident that Riley cannot be identified with any single core, and that her well-being depends on the interaction of many different mechanisms. At first, viewers are led to identify Riley with the lead character, the yellow, cheerful Joy. Yet eventually, it turns out that this identification was the critical mistake that threatened to ruin Riley's life. By thinking that she alone is the authentic essence of Riley, Joy browbeats all the other inner characters, thereby disrupting the delicate equilibrium of Riley's brain. Catharsis comes when Joy understands her mistake, and she, along with the viewers, realizes that Riley isn't Joy or sadness or any of the other characters. Riley is a complex story produced by the conflicts and collaborations of all the biochemical characters together. The truly amazing thing is not only that Disney dared to market a movie with such a radical message, but that it became a worldwide hit. Perhaps it succeeded so well because Inside Out is a comedy with a happy ending, and most viewers could easily have missed both its neurological meaning and its sinister implications. The same cannot be said about the most prophetic science fiction book of the 20th century. You cannot miss its sinister nature. Written almost a century ago, in 1931, it becomes more relevant with each passing year. When Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World, communism and fascism were entrenched in Russia and Italy. Nazism was on the rise in Germany, militaristic Japan was embarking on its war of conquest in China, and the entire world was gripped by the Great Depression. Yet Huxley managed to see through all these dark clouds and envision a future society without wars, famines, and plagues, enjoying uninterrupted peace, prosperity, and health. It is a consumerist world that gives complete free rein to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and whose supreme value is happiness. The underlying assumption of the book is that humans are biochemical algorithms. Science can hack the human algorithm, and technology can then be used to manipulate it. In this brave new world, the world government uses advanced biotechnology and social engineering to make sure that everyone is always content and no one has any reason to rebel. It is as if Joy, Sadness, and the other characters in Riley's brain have been turned into loyal government agents. There is, therefore, no need for a secret police, concentration camps, or a Ministry of Love a la Orwell's 1984. Indeed, Huxley's genius consists in showing that you can control people far more securely through love and pleasure than through fear and violence. It is clear that Orwell is describing a frightening nightmare world in 1984, and the only unanswered question is, how do we avoid such a terrible fate? Reading Brave New World is a disconcerting and challenging experience, in large part because you are hard-pressed to put your finger on what exactly makes it dystopian. The world is peaceful and prosperous, and everyone is supremely satisfied all the time. What could possibly be wrong with that? Huxley addresses this question directly in the novel's climactic moment. The dialogue between Mustafa Mond, the world controller for Western Europe, and John the Savage, who has lived all his life on a native reservation in New Mexico, and who is the only other man in London who still knows anything about Shakespeare or God. When John the Savage tries to incite the people of London to rebel against the system that controls them, they react with utter apathy to his call, but the police arrest him and bring him before Mustafa Mond. The World Controller has a pleasant chat with John, explaining that if he insists on being antisocial, he should just remove himself to some secluded place and live as a hermit. John then questions the views that underlie the global order, and accuses the world government of eliminating not just truth and beauty in its pursuit of happiness, but all that is noble and heroic in life. Mustafa Mond explains to the savage that civilization has absolutely no need of nobility or heroism. These things are symptoms of political inefficiency. In a properly organized society like ours, nobody has any opportunities for being noble or heroic. Conditions have got to be thoroughly unstable before the occasion can arise. Since there are no more wars, revolutions, or social conflicts, there is just no need for nobility or heroism. Similarly, in the past, people had to exert great effort and undergo years of hard moral training in order to overcome their anger, their hatred, and their dangerous passions. But now, if your anger or passion threatens to overwhelm you, all you need to do is swallow a few pills. Anybody can be virtuous now, concludes Mustafa. You can carry at least half your morality about in a bottle. Exasperated, the savage insists that effort and struggle have their merits, and asks Mustafa, isn't there something in living dangerously? The world controller agrees wholeheartedly that there is a great deal in living dangerously. Humans need strong stimulations, which is why the world government decreed that every citizen must undergo a violent passion surrogate treatment each month. These treatments mimic the physiological effects of extreme fear and rage, so that people can enjoy all the effects of murdering someone, or being murdered, without suffering any of the inconveniences. But I like the inconveniences, says the savage. We don't, said the controller. We prefer to do things comfortably. But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In fact, said Mustafa Mond, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. All right, then, said the savage defiantly. I'm claiming the right to be unhappy. Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent. The right to have syphilis and cancer. The right to have too little to eat. The right to be lousy. The right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow. The right to catch typhoid. The right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last. Mustafa Mond shrugged his shoulders. You're welcome, he said. John the Savage retires to an uninhabited wilderness and there lives as a hermit. Years of living on an Indian reservation and of being brainwashed by Shakespeare and religion have conditioned him to reject all the blessings of modernity. But word of such an unusual and exciting fellow quickly spreads. People flock to watch him and record all his doings, and soon enough he becomes a celebrity. Sick at heart of all the unwanted attention, the savage escapes the civilized matrix not by swallowing a red pill, but by hanging himself. Unlike the creators of The Matrix and The Truman Show, Huxley doubted the possibility of escape, because he questioned whether there was anybody to make the escape. Since your brain and your self are part of The Matrix, to escape The Matrix, you must escape yourself. That, however, is a possibility worth exploring. Escaping the narrow definition of self might well become a necessary survival skill in the 21st century.
Part 5. Resilience. How do you live in an age of bewilderment when the old stories have collapsed and no new story has yet emerged to replace them?
19. Education. Change is the only constant. Humankind is facing unprecedented revolutions. All our old stories are crumbling, and no new story has so far emerged to replace them. How can we prepare ourselves and our children for a world of such unprecedented transformations and radical uncertainties? A baby born today will be 30-something in 2050. If all goes well,
that baby will still be around in 2100, and might even be an active citizen of the 22nd century. What should we teach that baby that will help him or her survive and flourish in the world of 2050 or of the 22nd century? What kind of skills will he or she need in order to get a job, understand what is happening around him or her, and navigate the maze of life? Unfortunately, since nobody knows what the world will look like in 2050, not to mention 2100, we don't know the answer to these questions. Of course, humans have never been able to predict the future with accuracy. But today it is more difficult than ever before, because once technology enables us to engineer bodies, brains, and minds, we will no longer be able to be certain about anything, including things that previously seemed fixed and eternal. 1,000 years ago, in 1018, there were many things people didn't know about the future. But they were, nevertheless, convinced that the basic features of human society were not going to change. If you lived in China in 1018, you knew that by 1050 the Song Empire might collapse, the Khitans might invade from the north, and plagues might kill millions. However, it was clear to you that even in 1050, most people would still work as farmers and weavers. Rulers would still rely on humans to staff their armies and bureaucracies. Men would still dominate women. Life expectancy would still be about 40, and the human body would remain exactly the same. For that reason, in 1018, poor Chinese parents taught their children how to plant rice or weave silk. Wealthier parents taught their boys how to read the Confucian classics, write calligraphy, or fight on horseback. And they taught their girls to be modest and obedient housewives. It was obvious that these skills would still be needed in 1050. In contrast, today we have no idea how China or the rest of the world will look in 2050. We don't know what people will do for a living, we don't know how armies or bureaucracies will function, and we don't know what gender relations will be like. Some people will probably live much longer than today, and the human body itself might undergo an unprecedented revolution thanks to bioengineering and direct brain-to-computer interfaces. Much of what kids learn today will likely be irrelevant by 2050. At present, too many schools focus on cramming information into kids' brains. In the past, this made sense, because information was scarce, and even the slow trickle of existing information was repeatedly blocked by censorship. If you lived, say, in a small provincial town in Mexico in 1800, it was difficult for you to know much about the wider world. There was no radio, television, daily newspaper, or public library. Even if you were literate and had access to a private library, there was not much to read other than novels and religious tracts. The Spanish Empire heavily censored all texts printed locally and allowed only a dribble of vetted publications to be imported from the outside. Much the same was true if you lived in some provincial town in Russia, India, Turkey, or China. When modern schools came along, teaching every child to read and write and imparting the basic facts of geography, history, and biology, they represented an immense improvement. In contrast, in the 21st century we are flooded by enormous amounts of information, and the censors don't even try to block it. Instead, they are busy spreading misinformation or distracting us with irrelevancies. If you live in some provincial Mexican town and you have a smartphone, you can spend many lifetimes just reading Wikipedia, watching TED Talks, and taking free online courses. No government can hope to conceal all the information it doesn't like. On the other hand, it is alarmingly easy to inundate the public with conflicting reports and red herrings. People all over the world are but a click away from the latest accounts of the bombardment of Aleppo or of melting ice caps in the Arctic. But there are so many contradictory accounts that it is hard to know what to believe. Besides, countless other things are just a click away as well, making it difficult to focus. And when politics or science look too complicated, it is tempting to switch to some funny cat videos, celebrity gossip, or porn. In such a world, the last thing a teacher needs to give her pupils is more information. They already have far too much of it. Instead, people need the ability to make sense of information, to tell the difference between what is important and what is unimportant, and above all to combine many bits of information into a broad picture of the world. In truth, this has been the ideal of Western liberal education for centuries, but up till now even many Western schools have been rather slack in fulfilling it. Teachers allowed themselves to focus on imparting data while encouraging students to think for themselves. Due to their fear of authoritarianism, liberal schools have had a particular horror of grand narratives. They've assumed that as long as we give students lots of data and a modicum of freedom, the students will create their own picture of the world, and even if this generation fails to synthesize all the data into a coherent and meaningful story about the world, there will be plenty of time to construct a better synthesis in the future. We have now run out of time. The decisions we will make in the next few decades will shape the future of life itself, and we can make these decisions based only on our present worldview. If this generation lacks a comprehensive view of the cosmos, the future of life will be decided at random. The heat is on. Besides information, most schools also focus too much on providing students with a set of predetermined skills, such as solving differential equations, writing computer code in C++, identifying chemicals in a test tube, or conversing in Chinese. Yet, since we have no idea what the world and the job market will look like in 2050, we don't really know what particular skills people will need. We might invest a lot of effort teaching kids how to write in C++ or speak Chinese, only to discover that by 2050, AI can code software far better than humans, and a new Google Translate app will enable you to conduct a conversation in almost flawless Mandarin, Cantonese, or Hakka, even though you only know how to say ni hao. So what should we be teaching? Many pedagogical experts argue that schools should be switching to teaching the four C's: critical thinking, communication, collaboration, and creativity. More broadly, they believe, schools should downplay technical skills and emphasize general-purpose life skills. Most important of all will be the ability to deal with change, learn new things, and preserve your mental balance in unfamiliar situations. In order to keep up with the world of 2050, you will need not merely to invent new ideas and products, but above all, to reinvent yourself again and again. For as the pace of change increases, not just the economy, but the very meaning of being human is likely to mutate. Already in 1848, the Communist Manifesto declared that all that is solid melts into air. Marx and Engels, however, were thinking mainly about social and economic structures. By 2048, physical and cognitive structures will also melt into air, or into a cloud of data bits. In 1848, millions of people were losing their jobs on village farms and were going to the big cities to work in factories. But upon reaching the big city, they were unlikely to change their gender or to add a sixth sense. And if they found a job in some textile factory, they could expect to remain in that profession for the rest of their working lives. By 2048, people might have to cope with migrations to cyberspace, with fluid gender identities, and with new sensory experiences generated by computer implants. If they find both work and meaning in designing up-to-the-minute fashions for a 3D virtual reality game, within a decade, not just this particular profession, but all jobs demanding this level of artistic creation might be taken over by AI. So, at 25, you might introduce yourself on a dating site as a 25-year-old heterosexual woman who lives in London and works in a fashion shop. At 35, you might say you are a gender non-specific person undergoing age adjustment, whose neocortical activity takes place mainly in the new cosmos virtual world, and whose life mission is to go where no fashion designer has gone before. At 45, both dating and self-definitions are so passé. You just wait for an algorithm to find, or create, the perfect match for you. As for drawing meaning from the art of fashion design, you are so irrevocably outclassed by the algorithms that looking at your crowning achievements from the previous decade fills you with embarrassment rather than pride. and at 45, you still have many decades of radical change ahead of you. Please don't take this scenario literally. Nobody can predict the specific changes we will witness in the future. Any particular scenario is likely to be far from the truth. If somebody describes the world of the mid-21st century to you, and it sounds like science fiction, it is probably false. But then again, if somebody describes the world of the mid-21st century to you and it doesn't sound like science fiction, it is certainly false. We cannot be sure of the specifics. Change itself is the only certainty. Such profound change may well transform the basic structure of life, making discontinuity its most salient feature. From time immemorial, life was divided into two complementary parts, a period of learning followed by a period of working. In the first part of life, you accumulated information, developed skills, constructed a worldview, and built a stable identity. Even if, at 15, you spent most of your day working in your family's rice field, rather than in a formal school, the most important thing you were doing was learning how to cultivate rice, how to conduct negotiations with the greedy rice merchants from the big city, and how to resolve conflicts over land and water with the other villagers. In the second part of life, you relied on your accumulated skills to navigate the world, earn a living, and contribute to society. Of course, even at 50, you continued to learn new things about rice, merchants, and conflicts, but these were just small tweaks to your well-honed abilities. By the middle of the 21st century, accelerating change plus longer lifespans will make this traditional model obsolete. Life will come apart at the seams, and there will be less and less continuity between different periods of life. Who am I? Will be a more urgent and complicated question than ever before. This is likely to involve immense levels of stress. For change is almost always stressful, and after a certain age, most people just don't like to change. When you are 15, your entire life is change. Your body is growing, your mind is developing, your relationships are deepening. Everything is in flux, and everything is new. You are busy inventing yourself. Most teenagers find it frightening, but at the same time, it is also exciting. New vistas are opening before you, and you have an entire world to conquer. By the time you are 50, you don't want change, and most people have given up on conquering the world. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. You prefer stability. You have invested so much in your skills, your career, your identity, and your worldview that you don't want to start all over again. The harder you've worked on building something, the more difficult it is to let go of it and make room for something new. You might still cherish new experiences and minor adjustments, but most people in their 50s aren't ready to overhaul the deep structures of their identity and personality. There are neurological reasons for this. Though the adult brain is more flexible and volatile than was once thought, it is still less malleable than the teenage brain. Reconnecting neurons and rewiring synapses is hard work. But in the 21st century, you can't afford stability. If you try to hold on to some stable identity, job, or worldview, you risk being left behind as the world flies by you with a whoosh. Given that life expectancy is likely to increase, you might subsequently have to spend many decades as a clueless fossil. To stay relevant, not just economically, but above all socially, you will need the ability to constantly learn and to reinvent yourself, certainly at a young age like 50. As strangeness becomes the new normal, your past experiences, as well as the past experiences of the whole of humanity, will become less reliable guides. Humans as individuals, and humankind as a whole, will increasingly have to deal with things nobody ever encountered before, such as super-intelligent machines, engineered bodies, algorithms that can manipulate your emotions with uncanny precision, rapid man-made climate cataclysms, and the need to change your profession every decade. What is the right thing to do when confronting a completely unprecedented situation? How should you act when you are flooded by enormous amounts of information, and there is absolutely no way you can absorb and analyze it all? How do you live in a world where profound uncertainty is not a bug, but a feature? To survive and flourish in such a world, you will need a lot of mental flexibility and great reserves of emotional balance. You will have to repeatedly let go of some of what you know best and learn to feel at home with the unknown. Unfortunately, teaching kids to embrace the unknown while maintaining their mental balance is far more difficult than teaching them an equation in physics or the causes of the First World War. You cannot learn resilience by reading a book or listening to a lecture. Teachers themselves usually lack the mental flexibility that the 21st century demands, since they themselves are the product of the old educational system. The Industrial Revolution has bequeathed us the production line theory of education. In the middle of town, there is a large concrete building divided into many identical rooms, each room equipped with rows of desks and chairs. At the sound of a bell, you go to one of these rooms together with 30 other kids who were all born the same year as you. Every hour, a different grown-up walks in and starts talking. The grown-ups are all paid to do so by the government. One of them tells you about the shape of the earth, another tells you about the human past, and a third tells you about the human body. It is easy to laugh at this model, and almost everybody agrees that no matter its past achievements, it is now bankrupt. But so far we haven't created a viable alternative. Certainly not a scalable alternative that can be implemented in rural Mexico rather than just in wealthy California suburbs. Hacking humans. So, the best advice I can give a 15-year-old stuck in an outdated school somewhere in Mexico, India, or Alabama is, don't rely on the adults too much. Most of them mean well, but they just don't understand the world. In the past, it was a relatively safe bet to follow the adults, because they knew the world quite well, and the world changed slowly. But the 21st century is going to be different. Because of the increasing pace of change, you can never be certain whether what the adults are telling you is timeless wisdom or outdated bias. So, on what can you rely instead? Perhaps on technology? That's an even riskier gamble. Technology can help you a lot, but if technology gains too much power over your life, you might become a hostage to its agenda. Thousands of years ago, humans invented agriculture, but this technology enriched just a tiny elite, while enslaving the majority of humans. Most people found themselves working from sunrise till sunset, plucking weeds, carrying water buckets, and harvesting corn under a blazing sun. It could happen to you, too. Technology isn't bad. If you know what you want in life, technology can help you get it. But if you don't know what you want in life, it will be all too easy for technology to shape your aims for you and take control of your life. Especially as technology gets better at understanding humans, you might increasingly find yourself serving it instead of it serving you. Have you seen those zombies who roam the streets with their faces glued to their smartphones? Do you think they control the technology, or does the technology control them? Should you rely on yourself, then? That sounds great on Sesame Street or in an old-fashioned Disney film, but in real life, it doesn't work so well. Even Disney is coming to realize it. Just like Riley Anderson, most people barely know themselves, and when they try to listen to themselves, they easily become prey to external manipulations. The voice we hear inside our heads is never trustworthy, because it always reflects state propaganda, ideological brainwashing, and commercial advertisements, not to mention biochemical bugs. As biotechnology and machine learning improve, it will become easier to manipulate people's deepest emotions and desires, and it will become more dangerous than ever to just follow your heart. When Coca-Cola, Amazon, Baidu, or the government knows how to pull the strings of your heart and press the buttons of your brain, will you still be able to tell the difference between yourself and their marketing experts? To succeed at such a daunting task, you will need to work very hard at getting to know your operating system better, to know what you are and what you want from life. This is, of course, the oldest advice in the book. Know thyself. For thousands of years, philosophers and prophets have urged people to know themselves. But this advice was never more urgent than in the 21st century, because unlike in the days of Lao Tzu or Socrates, now you have serious competition. Coca-Cola, Amazon, Baidu, and the government are all racing to hack you. Not your smartphone, not your computer, and not your bank account. They are in a race to hack you and your organic operating system. You might have heard that we are living in the era of hacking computers, but that's not even half the truth. In fact, we are living in the era of hacking humans. The algorithms are watching you right now. They're watching where you go, what you buy, whom you meet. Soon they will monitor all your steps, all your breaths, all your heartbeats. They are relying on big data and machine learning to get to know you better and better. And once these algorithms know you better than you know yourself, they can control and manipulate you, and you won't be able to do much about it. You will live in the Matrix or in the Truman Show. In the end, it's a simple empirical matter. If the algorithms indeed understand what's happening within you better than you understand it yourself, authority will shift to them. Of course, you might be perfectly happy ceding all authority to the algorithms and trusting them to decide things for you and for the rest of the world. If so, just relax and enjoy the ride. You don't need to do anything about it. The algorithms will take care of everything. If, however, you want to retain some control over your personal existence and the future of life, you have to run faster than the algorithms, faster than Amazon and the government, and get to know yourself before they do. To run fast, don't take much baggage with you. Leave all your illusions behind. They are very heavy. 20. Meaning. Life is not a story. Who am I? What should I do in life? What is the meaning of life? Humans have been asking these questions from time immemorial. Every generation needs a new answer, because what we know and don't know keeps changing. Given everything we know and don't know about science, about God, about politics, and about religion, what is the best answer we can give today? What kind of an answer do people expect? In almost all cases, when people ask about the meaning of life, they expect to be told a story. Homo sapiens is a storytelling animal that thinks in stories rather than in numbers or graphs, and believes that the universe itself works like a story, replete with heroes and villains, conflicts and resolutions, climaxes and happy endings. When we look for the meaning of life, we want a story that will explain what reality is all about and what my particular role is in the cosmic drama. This role makes me a part of something bigger than myself and gives meaning to all my experiences and choices. One popular story, told for thousands of years to billions of anxious humans, explains that we are all part of an eternal cycle that encompasses and connects all beings. Each being has a distinctive function to fulfill in the cycle. To understand the meaning of life means to understand your unique function, and to live a good life means to accomplish that function. The Hindu epic, the Bhagavad Gita, relates how in the midst of a murderous civil war, the great warrior prince Arjuna is consumed with doubt. Seeing his friends and relatives in the opposing army, he hesitates over whether to fight and kill them. He begins to wonder what good and evil are, who decided it, and what the purpose of human life is. The god Krishna then explains to him that within the great cosmic cycle, each being possesses a unique dharma, the path you must follow and the duties you must fulfill. If you realize your dharma, no matter how hard the path may be, you enjoy peace of mind and liberation from doubt. If you refuse to follow your dharma and try to adopt somebody else's path or wander about with no path at all, you will disturb the cosmic balance and will never be able to find either peace or joy. It makes no difference what your particular path is, as long as you follow it. A washerwoman who devotedly follows the way of the washerwoman is far superior to a prince who strays off the way of the prince. Having understood the meaning of life, Arjuna duly proceeds to follow his dharma as a warrior. He kills his friends and relatives, leads his army to victory, and becomes one of the most esteemed and beloved heroes of the Hindu world. The 1994 Disney epic The Lion King repackaged this ancient story for modern audiences, with the young lion Simba standing in for Arjuna. When Simba wants to know the meaning of existence, his father, the Lion King Mufasa, tells him about the great circle of life. Mufasa explains that the antelopes eat the grass, the lions eat the antelopes, and when the lions die, their bodies decompose and feed the grass. This is how life continues from generation to generation, provided each animal plays its part in the drama. Everything is connected, and everyone depends on everyone else. So if even a blade of grass fails to fulfill its vocation, the entire circle of life might unravel. Simba's vocation, says Mufasa, is to rule the Lion Kingdom after Mufasa's death and keep the other animals in order. However, when Mufasa is prematurely murdered by his evil brother Scar, young Simba blames himself for the catastrophe. Racked with guilt, he leaves the Lion Kingdom, shuns his royal destiny, and wanders off into the wilderness. There he meets two other outcasts, a meerkat and a warthog, and together they spend a few carefree years off the beaten path. Their antisocial philosophy means that they answer every problem by chanting Hakuna Matata, no worries. But Simba cannot escape his dharma. As he matures, he becomes increasingly troubled, not knowing who he is and what he should do in life. At the climactic moment of the movie, the spirit of Mufasa reveals himself to Simba in a vision and reminds Simba of the circle of life and of his royal identity. Simba also learns that in his absence, the evil Scar has assumed the throne and mismanaged the kingdom, which now suffers greatly from disharmony and famine. Simba finally understands who he is and what he must do. He returns to the Lion Kingdom, kills his uncle, becomes king, and re-establishes harmony and prosperity. The movie ends with a proud Simba presenting his newly born heir to the assembled animals, ensuring the continuation of the great circle of life. The circle of life presents the cosmic drama as a circular story. For all Simba and Arjuna know, lions have been eating antelopes and warriors have been fighting battles for countless eons and will continue to do so forever and ever. The eternal repetition gives power to the story, implying that this is the natural course of things, and that if Arjuna shuns combat or if Simba refuses to become king, they will be rebelling against the very laws of nature. If I believe in some version of the Circle of Life story, it means that I have a fixed and true identity that determines my duties in life. For many years I may be doubtful or ignorant of this identity, but one day, in some great climactic moment, it will be revealed, and I will understand my role in the cosmic drama. Though I may subsequently encounter many trials and tribulations, I will be free of doubts and despair. Other religions and ideologies believe in a linear cosmic drama, which has a definitive beginning, a not-too-long middle, and a once-and-for-all ending. For example, the Muslim story says that in the beginning Allah created the entire universe and laid down its laws. He then revealed those laws to humans in the Quran. Unfortunately, ignorant and wicked people rebelled against Allah and tried to break or hide these laws. And it is up to virtuous and loyal Muslims to uphold the laws and spread knowledge of them to others. Eventually, on Judgment Day, Allah will pass judgment on the conduct of each and every individual. He will reward the righteous with everlasting bliss in paradise and toss the wicked into the burning pits of hell. This grand narrative implies that my small but important role in life is to follow Allah's commands, spread knowledge of his laws, and ensure obedience to his wishes. If I believe the Muslim story, I find meaning in praying 5 times a day, donating money to build a new mosque, and struggling against apostates and infidels. Even the most mundane activities, washing hands, drinking wine, having sex, are imbued with cosmic meaning. Nationalism, too, upholds a linear story. The Zionist story begins with the biblical adventures and achievements of the Jewish people, recounts 2,000 years of exile and persecution, reaches a climax with the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel, and looks forward to the day when Israel will enjoy peace and prosperity and become a moral and spiritual beacon to the world. If I believe in the Zionist story, I will conclude that my life's mission is to advance the interests of the Jewish nation by protecting the purity of the Hebrew language, by fighting to regain lost Jewish territory, or perhaps by having and raising a new generation of loyal Israeli children. In this case, too, even humdrum undertakings are infused with meaning. On Independence Day, Israeli schoolchildren often sing a popular Hebrew song together, praising any action done for the sake of the motherland. One kid sings, "I've built a house in the land of Israel." Another kid chants, "I've planted a tree in the land of Israel." A third chimes in with, "I've written a poem in the land of Israel." And so it goes, on and on, until finally they all join together in a chorus, singing, "So we have a house, and a tree, and a poem, and whatever else you would like to add, in the land of Israel." Communism tells an analogous story, but focuses on class rather than ethnicity. The Communist Manifesto opens with this proclamation: "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guild master and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large, or in the common ruin of the contending classes." The manifesto goes on to explain that in modern times, society as a whole is more and more splitting up into two great hostile camps, into two great classes directly facing each other, bourgeoisie and proletariat. Their struggle will end with the victory of the proletariat, which will signal the end of history and the establishment of the communist paradise on earth, in which nobody will own anything and everyone will be completely free and happy. If I believe in this communist story, I will conclude that my life's mission is to speed up the global revolution by writing fiery pamphlets to raise class consciousness, organizing strikes and demonstrations, or perhaps assassinating greedy capitalists and fighting against their lackeys. The story gives meaning to even the smallest of gestures, such as boycotting a brand that exploits textile workers in Bangladesh, or arguing with my capitalist pig father-in-law over Christmas dinner. When I look at the entire range of stories that seek to define my true identity and give meaning to my actions, I am struck by the realization that scale matters very little. Some stories, such as Simba's Circle of Life, seem to stretch on for eternity. It is only against the backdrop of the entire universe that I can know who I am. Other stories, such as most nationalist and tribal myths, are puny by comparison. Zionism holds sacred the adventures of about 0.2% of humankind and 0.005% of the Earth's surface during a tiny fraction of human history. The Zionist story fails to ascribe any meaning to the Chinese empires, to the tribes of New Guinea, and to the Andromeda Galaxy, as well as to the countless eons that passed before the existence of Moses, Abraham, and the evolution of apes. Such myopia can have serious repercussions. For example, one of the major obstacles for any peace treaty between Israelis and Palestinians is that Israelis are unwilling to divide the city of Jerusalem. They argue that this city is the eternal capital of the Jewish people, and surely you cannot compromise on something eternal. What are a few dead people compared to eternity? This is, of course, utter nonsense. Eternity is at the very least 13.8 billion years, the current age of the universe. Planet Earth was formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and humans have existed for at least 2 million years. In contrast, the city of Jerusalem was established just 5,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are at most 3,000 years old. This hardly qualifies as eternity. As for the future, physics tells us that planet Earth will be absorbed by an expanding sun about 7.5 billion years from now, and that our universe will continue to exist for at least 13 billion years more. Does anyone seriously believe that the Jewish people, the State of Israel, or the city of Jerusalem will still exist 13,000 years from now, let alone in 13 billion years? Looking to the future,
Zionism has a horizon of no more than a few centuries, yet it is enough to exhaust the imagination of most Israelis and somehow qualify as eternity. And people are willing to make sacrifices for the sake of the eternal city, which they would probably refuse to make for an ephemeral collection of houses. As a teenager in Israel, I too was initially captivated by the nationalist promise to become part of something bigger than myself. I wanted to believe that if I gave my life to the nation, I would live forever in the nation. But I couldn't fathom what it meant to live forever in the nation. The phrase sounded very profound, but what did it actually mean? I remember one particular Memorial Day ceremony when I was about 13 or 14. Whereas in the United States, Memorial Day is marked mainly by bargain shopping, in Israel, Memorial Day is an extremely solemn and important event. Schools hold ceremonies to remember the fallen soldiers in Israel's many wars. The kids dress in white, recite poems, sing songs, place wreaths, and wave flags. So there I was at my school ceremony, dressed in white, and in between flag waving and poem recitations, I naturally thought that when I grew up, I too wanted to be a fallen soldier. After all, if I was a heroic fallen soldier who had sacrificed his life for Israel, then I would have all these kids reciting poems and waving flags in my honor. But then I thought, wait a minute, if I am dead, how will I know that these kids are really reciting poems in my honor? So I tried to imagine myself dead, and I imagined myself lying under some white tombstone in a neat military cemetery, listening to the poems coming from above the ground. But then I thought, if I am dead, then I cannot hear any poems, because I don't have ears, and I don't have a brain, and I cannot hear or feel anything. So what's the point? Even worse, by the time I was 13, I knew that the universe was a couple of billion years old, and would probably go on existing for billions of years more. Could I realistically expect Israel to exist for such a long time? Would Homo sapiens kids dressed in white still recite poems in my honor after 200 million years? There was something fishy about the whole business. If you happen to be Palestinian, don't feel smug. It is just as unlikely that there will be any Palestinians around 200 million years from now. In all probability, by then, there won't be any mammals whatsoever. Other national movements are just as narrow-minded. Serbian nationalism cares little about events in the Jurassic era, whereas Korean nationalists believe that a small peninsula on the east coast of Asia is the only part of the cosmos that really matters in the grand scheme of things. Of course, even Simba, for all his devotion to the everlasting circle of life, never contemplates the fact that lions, antelopes, and grass aren't really eternal. Simba does not consider what the universe was like before the evolution of mammals, nor what the fate of his beloved African savanna will be once humans kill all the lions and cover the grasslands with asphalt and concrete. Would this render Simba's life utterly meaningless? All stories are incomplete. Yet in order to construct a viable identity for myself and give meaning to my life, I don't really need a complete story devoid of blind spots and internal contradictions. To give meaning to my life, a story needs to satisfy just two conditions. First, it must give me some role to play. A New Guinean tribesman is unlikely to believe in Zionism or in Serbian nationalism, because these stories don't care at all about New Guinea and its people. Like movie stars, humans like only those scripts that reserve an important role for them. Second, whereas a good story need not extend to infinity, it must extend beyond my horizons. The story must provide me with an identity and give meaning to my life by embedding me within something bigger than myself. But there is always a danger that I might start wondering what gives meaning to that something bigger. If the meaning of my life is to help the proletariat or the Polish nation, what exactly gives meaning to the proletariat or to the Polish nation? There is a story of a man who claimed that the world was kept in place by resting on the back of a huge elephant. When asked what the elephant stood on, he replied that it stood on the back of a large turtle. And the turtle? On the back of an even bigger turtle. And that bigger turtle? The man snapped, "Don't worry about it. From there it's turtles all the way down. Most successful stories remain open-ended. They never need to explain where meaning ultimately comes from, because they are so good at